Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. The lack of safe, decent, and affordable housing for families of low income has always been a problem in North Carolina, but recent spikes in rents and housing prices, particularly in urban areas, combined with an overall decline in public investments and subsidies, has left more than a million North Carolinians in a real bind. And while there are indications that the scope and urgency of the problem is finally finding its way onto the radar screens of the state's political leaders, particularly at the local level, public investments at the national and state levels remain pathetically inadequate. Earlier this week, I sat down with one of our state's most knowledgeable experts and advocates on the subject, North Carolina Housing Coalition Executive Director Samuel Gunter. Welcome back to News and Views. Good to have you back with us.
Good to be back.
You are the head of the North Carolina Housing Coalition, and it's fair to say that the issue of housing and housing affordability has really started to finally grab hold of attention in our public consciousness and in the public policy debates. One issue that's kind of driven that recently, or one development, has been the sad and shocking news out of McDougal Terrace, a public housing facility in Durham. That's sort of focused people's attention on the fact that we got some big problems, both in public housing and in making private housing affordable to people.
I had some comments on this right after families started being evacuated from McDougal Terrace, which is the oldest and the largest public housing complex in Durham, that this is something that was both entirely preventable and also something that is entirely predictable. Mm. This is the completely expected consequence of decades of disinvestment in public housing, which is a system that we have essentially, in large part, abandoned since the 80s, going back all the way to the 80s, and really before that. But
there was a time in America where we built large public housing complexes to provide affordable housing to people, and it's like, that's no longer the case, but we've still got a lot of infrastructure that exists that's been neglected.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the ways that I talk about housing when I go around the state is, at its simplest, this is a basic math problem with two variables. How much money do you make as a family? How much does your housing cost? You can move either or both of those levers to get to affordability for your family. The challenge in our country is that the lower down the income spectrum you are, the harder it is to make that math work. And so where public housing fits in is when you've got a family budget that can't sustain rents out on the market, you have a system in place to provide housing that we get that rent affordable to you using heavy subsidy. The challenge with public housing, with housing choice vouchers or Section 8 as it's known, is that if you qualify, for the folks, that really only one in four people who qualify get it. Get access to it, right?
Just so because there's just not enough stock.
Well, there's not enough vouchers out there, right? And there's not enough public housing supply to house all of those folks. And the reality of the math is, in any kind of housing complex, there's maintenance costs, there's property taxes, there's all the things, there's the salaries of the people who run the place that has to be maintained. And the way it happens out on the market is it's maintained through rents. Right. But if the whole reason for public housing existing is the folks who are living there cannot afford the rents that are going to sustain that property, you have to backfill that with subsidy. And what we've done for decades and decades is we have backfilled it with not enough subsidy. And so the end result is this public housing that is falling apart. And it's an infrastructure problem because housing really is public infrastructure that's just privately held for the most part, right? I think a lot of communities around the state outside of public housing are seeing this as they're trying to attract companies to move to their locales, to their counties, to their municipalities. And the companies are seeing a lot that's attractive, but then they look at the housing stock and in some places nothing new has been built since the mid-1970s. And they're saying, well, we can't house our workforce here. And smaller local governments are looking for solutions to be able to deal with large vacant housing stock, you know, so it's a challenge across the market. But what we see on the public housing side is a commitment that was made that we are going to house this population, but then we're not living up to that commitment.
Right. Can you even sort of give us a ballpark of what the sort of scope of the problem in our state is? I presume, you know, we see the rents are soaring, housing prices continue to go up. Obviously, wages are not keeping up with that. I take it there must be hundreds of thousands of families that really housing is, as a practical matter, not really affordable in our state.
Yeah, so one of the ways that we talk about this in our world is cost-burdened and severely cost-burdened. And just to define those, if you are paying more than 30% of your household income on your housing costs, and that's rent or mortgage and utilities and all of the basic housing costs, we call you cost burdened. If you're paying more than 50%, more than half of your income, you're severely cost burdened. So we got just shy of 1.2 million families in the state that are cost burdened, meaning they're paying more than 30%. And we've got just shy of 500,000 families in the state paying more than half of their income just on their housing costs, right? So it gives you a sense of the scale. Mentioning public housing and McDougal Terrace, really since the 80s, we transitioned, and the primary driver of affordable housing in the country has been the low-income housing tax credit.
It's a way to incentivize private developers to build affordable housing.
Exactly. So instead of backlogging that gap in what rents can sustain with a appropriated subsidy, it essentially gives you a credit to attract investors. So that is private capital, right? And so it's housing that's privately held, but because of this system, you can get the rents down lower.
You can make some money even though you're renting at low rents. The developers and the people behind this can actually still make some money and make...
Well, the idea is what we're not trying to do is create poor housing, right? It's the same housing that you would find out on the market. We're just finding a way through some kind of mechanism, in this case, it's the tax credit, to bring those rents down. Part of the challenge with the low-income housing tax credit, our biggest new construction and rehab tool, particularly on the multifamily side for renters, is that each year in our state, that tool is going to get about 3,500, maybe 4,000 units.
Mm-hmm.
That's our biggest tool. And once again, we got just shy of 500,000 families paying more than half their income.
So we should be caught up sometime by about the 23rd century or something. Like
I mean, the reality is we're losing ground,
right? Of course.
And especially in some of these larger metro areas where some of the stock that is what we would call naturally affordable, which means really that it's mostly substandard housing that's getting bought up and redeveloped into luxury apartment complexes, that stock is coming out and we're losing it, but we're not replacing it at the same rate. It's disappearing.
Obviously, there's federal money that comes for housing. There's local governments sometimes have bonds. I know there's talk of doing one in Raleigh. Durham's done it to provide affordable housing. We also have the state of North Carolina provides housing through the budget. But we've had this budget stalemate going on in North Carolina for, 7-8 months now. And although they've passed these mini budgets to kind of keep government running, this is an area that's kind of fallen, one of the areas that's kind of falling through the cracks, right?
Yeah, so we have a couple of ways that the state engages in housing. So we have a state housing finance agency, which does quite a lot. And the General Assembly appropriates a little bit of money to them every year. And so we have two big pots of appropriation. One is the North Carolina Housing Trust Fund, which is our most flexible source of funding. It does a lot across the state. The other is the Workforce Housing Loan Program, which comes alongside the federal low-income housing tax credit and helps make those deals work in predominantly low-income counties, where it would be really hard to make that math work. The Housing Trust Fund is a recurring expense, meaning right now it's there, it exists, because of the way the budget works. When we're at an impasse, we just revert back to all the recurring expenses. The Workforce Housing Loan Program, however, is not. And so we saw, where are we at, 2 weeks ago at this point, at time of recording, all of the pre-applications for the credit cycle to develop low-income housing tax credit units. Those applications are due, and we have no Workforce Housing Loan Program. So we're going to have an entire year of credit cycle without that added resource. And it looks like we're probably going to have 2 years of that.
Yeah.
But to give you a sense of scale, that state housing trust fund, which before the foreclosure crisis was about $20 million for the state, is now at $7.6 million for the state. And so when you think about the city of...
One nice big mansion. Maybe.
Yeah. So when you think about the city of Charlotte putting a $50 million housing bond on the ballot and asking for the private sector to match that, Durham putting a $95 million housing bond on the ballot, Asheville put 25, Greensboro put 25 on the ballot. And our statewide most flexible source of funding is at $7.6 million. It is not a resource that goes very far. Even though it does incredible work, particularly on the rehab and repair side, there's a lot that it does. Also for context, the Workforce Housing Loan Program is something that replaced a state tax credit that we had for years and years in the state. By many accounts, it was the envy of the nation. A lot of other states wish they had the companion credit that we had. The last year of that credit was worth about $55 million, $60 million for the state, and it was replaced with a $10 million loan program. And so we've gotten that up to 20, but we've been taking steps backwards. We are still disinvesting. And it puts all of these local governments that are putting up their own money now, it puts that into context. Yeah. the retreat that's happening at the federal level, the retreat that is happening in large part in the appropriation world at the state level, local governments have had to foot the bill for a lot of things that before there were other resources for.
Our time is limited, but before we let you go, I want to ask you about, in general, there's a sense that this issue is getting more and more attention, that politicians are paying attention. Leaders have finally grasped the fact that they can't ignore this issue, or we're going to have more and more people living in really tough situations. I know you've got a big lobby day scheduled at the General Assembly coming up in coming months. Are you hopeful that maybe this is finally starting to penetrate the consciousness of leaders and that we might see a turnaround on this in the months and years ahead?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of momentum in my time doing this work. You know, 4 years ago, you go up and talk to folks and housing may or may not be on their radar. That's not true anymore. I don't have to spend a lot of time with an elected official convincing them that this is something they have to pay attention to. We're on a different phase now. We're in a, here's what we need to do, and are we going to actually have the commitment to do something impactful? And we've seen a lot of streams. There was a bipartisan working group in the North Carolina General Assembly that was created. The Urban Institute has been brought down to do a statewide gaps analysis. There have been convenings by the metro mayors, the rural center. There have been all of these conversations happening at the League of Municipalities Association, county commissioners, conversations happening at the Housing Recovery Support Function of the State Disaster Recovery Task Force, the Interagency Council for Coordinating Homeless Programs, all these different conversations that are happening around the state that have identified housing as one of the key challenges that we face. And so I have a lot of hope that there is going to be some momentum leading into 2021 that we can see some significant investments made. And thank you for mentioning the lobby day on May 5th, when folks are back for the short legislative session. We are going to be having our first statewide legislative day for housing. We just pushed out the save the date this week, and there will be more details coming. But our hope is to have a critical mass of folks from around the state communicating very, very clearly to their elected officials that our current level of investment is unacceptable, that housing sits at the heart of every single one of our systems. And in order for any of them to work, folks need to have a safe, decent, and affordable place to live.
Well, Samuel Gunter of the North Carolina Housing Coalition, thanks so much for your fine work. Folks want to check your organization out, nchousing.org, right?
Absolutely.
Treasure trove of important information there. Come to the event on May 5th at the General Assembly and get engaged in this critical issue. Thanks so much. We'll talk again this spring. Maybe we'll talk about some good news.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Be sure to check us out online and subscribe to our free newsletters at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, it's Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.